The next case is 96-1467, George Harris versus Mazzongo Kennedy.
Slows down as necessary, and proceeds through the stop sign cautiously and with due regard. So now the question becomes, if that's a governing law for the city to maintain a defensive immunity, are there three questions to solve? And if we look at the evidence, is there evidentiary facts that support the plaintiff's position? So it should have gone to a jury, that is, evidence upon which the ultimate decision could turn, could change the jury verdict. And I think certainly there is, there's three issues of fact. One is the slowing down that is necessary. The requirement of 4511.03 is now set forth the specific speed limit that the ambulance must go. Just slow down as necessary.
It seems to me, Mr. Levy, that your argument on that particular element is that because there was a crash, or a collision, then the driver could not have slowed as necessary. Is that legitimate?
No, Your Honor.
Particularly in the scenario where we have black eyes.
No, Your Honor. It's more the fact, not that there was a collision, but that prior to the collision, that the ambulance driver admittedly lost control. But that, I think, is the main nature of failing to slow down as necessary. In addition to which, the inference that arises from the facts. The ambulance driver says, I'm only going to 5 to 10 miles at the point that I tried to stop. But the evidence shows that the ambulance traveled across 4 lanes of traffic, smashed a car, knocked it up onto a curb, itself went up onto a curb. One of the plaintiffs testified that ambulance had to be going some speed to do all that. I think the inference arises that the credibility of the ambulance driver is whitened out here, and the inferences are to be taken, I submit, for a motion for summary judgment in favor of the party that's been made.
But there's really no one at the scene that contradicts the 5 to 10 mile an hour that's testified in the record. There's no other estimation of speed.
There is no other estimation of exact speed, Your Honor, but I suggest that the evidence is solid to raise an inference that the driver was going a lot faster than that. Plus, the requirement is to slow down as necessary. I'm taking as necessary to mean, answer to the first honor's question, not to lose control when you're going through an intersection.
But I mean, we don't have to add the factor of ice. I mean, it would, that when someone is unaware that there's ice, that that's the major black ice, is slow down as necessary, knowing that there's ice or not knowing that there's ice?
Well, Your Honor, I beg to differ. The evidence on the record shows that the streets generally were snow and ice covered. The evidence shows that the ambulance driver himself said that in his training he was made aware that he had bad conditions, to be wary of them. His denial that he saw that patch of ice does not take away, in my opinion, from the jury, the factual question of whether he knew or should have known to look out for ice. Because we have, again, there's testimony that the weather conditions are there. The inferences we submit should be strongly favored the person against whom the summary judgment is sought.
But that person has to report something to permit this inference. And then I guess we'll get to that. What do we have in response to the motion for summary judgment? We have they're going some speed. Is that what we have?
Not only some speed, but the impact of the collision to travel across 4 lanes of traffic, which is in the record, on Superior, which is a major thorough street, through street in Cleveland, 4 lanes, to knock that vehicle with such impact up onto the curb to itself, that is the ambulance, to be at such a speed to after hitting it, itself to end up on that opposite curb 4 lanes away. In addition to the one thing saying must be one speed.
There was no expert that took all those factors into consideration and testified that from the observation of the damage and so forth, the vehicle had to be going 35 miles an hour. There's nothing to contradict. All I'm trying to say is there's nothing to contradict the 5 to 10, even though there is damage, heavily damaged, all these factors. there is nothing that pulls all those factors together and says, in my estimation, they're going 40 miles an hour from what I observed at the accident scene. There's nothing like that, is there?
There's nothing specific, but, Your Honor, I don't think that requires an expert any more than what is very keen for defense lawyers to do today in accident situations is to show a picture of no property damage to the vehicle, ergo there couldn't have been a heavy impact. There's no expert. It's an inference. Reasonable people who drive vehicles to see accidents have a right as late people.
But that has to go to injury to people. We're talking about speed. The two different, I look at them as two different factors. You have to counter the allegation that the EMS person was not in excessive speed at the scene, so 5 to 10. I think that in summary judgment, you should consider countering that type of testimony with other testimony, don't you?
Your Honor, again, I think it was covered in the extra testimony. Again, yes, I agree with Your Honor. There was no testimony as to any contrary exact speed. But
you feel then the testimony by the people about the damage to the car, about all these other things, were they presented to the court too in evidence form that the observations of the vehicles and the distance they were driven and so forth, was that before the court too?
Everything I mentioned was before the court, the deposition testimony, which were filed with the common police court, first of all, in the motion for summary judgment.
Was there evidence, I looked for it in the brief, I didn't see it, maybe I missed it, evidence how fast the plaintiff was driving?
Plaintiff was stopped or virtually stopped. What happened is you have a key intersection, so he doesn't see the flashing lights. And in fact, the ambulance driver admits on his deposition that he didn't see the plaintiff until virtually the last second when they're coming into the intersection, and they meet, unfortunately. But he says he's in the furthest lane away. The plaintiff's also testified, it's in the record, the furthest, I think it's the southernmost lane away from the ambulance as it enters the intersection.
So the ambulance did not
stop or virtually stop, is his testimony.
So the ambulance didn't push the car across four lanes, and the ambulance went across four lanes and hit the car and pushed it up. Do we know how? We don't know how large, what the length of the patch of ice, I guess, do we?
No, you are correct. It's the ambulance that went across four lanes, hits the car, and knocks it up onto the sidewalk, and the ambulance has enough force when it in itself continues up onto the sidewalk. The car doesn't stop.
Yeah. Can an inference be drawn that as a vehicle approaches a T intersection that it's likely to slow to 5 to 10 miles an hour because it can't go straight through? It's going to have to make a turn one way or the other. It has to stop or at least slow down. Usually a vehicle wouldn't make that kind of a turn at 30, 40, 50 miles an hour, I would guess. Is that?
Your Honor, I'm not.
Doesn't that support, I guess my question, doesn't that, the fact it was a T intersection, tend to support the testimony of the driver of the emergency vehicle that he had slowed to 5 to 10 miles an hour before when he hit the ice?
It tends to support it, yes, Your Honor, but it does not support the conclusion as a matter of law that he slowed down as necessary. I think as necessary requires consideration of all attending circumstances, which includes there's no vision of the light flashing. There's disputed testimony as to any sudden, which we'll get to in a second. So it didn't slow down as necessary.
Well, slowing down as necessary with black ice means he would have stopped before he hit the ice, literally. And that's really what you're arguing. You have to be arguing that. If you take his testimony as truthful that he slowed to 5 to 10 miles an hour as he approached the intersection, the only slower he could have gone virtually is to stop before he hit the ice, isn't it? What he's saying is that I slowed as necessary to go through the intersection safely, but I hit the ice, and that causes me to go faster or to not stop.
What's absent from that testimony, though, Your Honor, is what speed he was going before he slowed to 5 to 10 miles an hour. And I'm not saying he has to go 40. There's one case that held that because emergency vehicle was going 40, they determined it was too fast. But that's not the criteria that it has to be going 40 miles an hour to be going faster than necessary. What if it was going 20 miles, 30 miles an hour before it slowed to 5 to 10? What if based upon the facts we have, you can say, no, maybe it wasn't 140, but maybe it was 115 to 20. The fact that he knew the weather condition, the fact that he lost control of his vehicle, especially at a dangerous T intersection, to me, is a jury question of whether he slowed as necessary. No, I don't think he had to stop to avoid losing control, because we don't know what his speed was before he slowed to 5 to 10. We don't know that it really was 5 to 10. Maybe it was 15 to 20 as he came up to the stop sign, and that could have been enough to lose control and lose it on ice. So I don't know that he had to stop.
Counsel, our court is not an error court. As opposed to court of appeals, we aren't usually calling balls and strikes on who's stopped. So what law does this case present to the state?
First of all, Your Honor, reading the decisions below, I think they, based upon their citations and reasoning in the appellate court, I think that they misapply the proper Ohio law. They seem to apply A and B to proceed, that is, without due recognition to 45.1103. For instance, they cite Lipson, which is not having to do with siren, but that's a fire engine case.
Is it your position that assuming no siren, and we must assume no siren on summary judgment, that the driver cannot meet 45.1103? Is that your position?
That's my opinion, but I think at a minimum it's a jury question. I don't think it's a matter of law.
To decide what is a jury question is not... Everybody knows the law on Rule 56, so that's calling balls and strikes. So I'm still wondering what we're doing here with this case for statewide assistance in understanding the law, or adding some statutory understanding, something like that.
First, I think that any time a vehicle at a T intersection loses control of the vehicle, and a T intersection going to a stop sign or a red light, that automatically is a failure to comply with 45.1103. I think
if they hit ice, you have to include if they hit black ice, that would be an issue. That'd be a statement of law that you'd want us to make.
Yes, Your Honor. Given the balancing of the risk of the other people using the highways at a T intersection, I think also that the inferences and credibility are always issues for a jury under 56, which does not seem to have been adhered to by reading of the appellate opinion. And that's the issue. I would love to see that the court go further even and say that a lack of a siren is a failure to use due regard, at least in the narrow circumstance of proceeding through a stop sign or through a red traffic light, as that avoided this accident. His ability to flash the lights did not exist by all testimony in this case.
You'd like us to add some things to the statute, wouldn't you? It sounds like to me.
Well,
the statute doesn't say that.
It's the court's interpretation of the statute of what is required to satisfy 45.1103.
Thank you, Mr. Levy. Mr. Hannon.
General duties of care, but they do not impose individual liability. To that extent, the undisputed facts in this case establish Kennedy was entitled to immunity on 744-0386, and that aspect of the judgment should be affirmed.
If it had been you or I going through this stop sign, causing this accident, would we, under the facts of this case, been liable? Disregarding the stop sign, we would have been liable, wouldn't we?
In an ordinary case,
yes.
Negligence, there would be liability.
So the only, I know, so the only reason that defendant in this case is not liable is because it is a governmental entity.
Well,
on the basis of sovereign immunity.
Performing an important government.
I understand. But is that correct? Because, okay. Is there any good reason in the law why a governmental entity should, in fact, be immune when the rest of us are?
First of all, I'll point out it's an important issue that Justice Douglas, you're raising. It's not one of the claims I'm raised in.
I concede that. I was going to ask him that, and I thought that, you know, we've been through it so many times that I just wondered if there was anything we had missed, other than the fact that sovereign immunity seems to be, as the General Assembly at some point said, ought to be in vogue, and therefore government can do to its people under these circumstances whatever it chooses without liability.
No. I think what the General Assembly did is strike a reasonable balance, because there are competing interests at stake here. One is the importance of public functions such as police, fire, and EMS serve and protect society's interests. Balanced against that are legitimate interests of persons who have been injured by misconduct. And the balance that the General Assembly struck, and I think a reasonable balance, is that where the employee is performing one of those important governmental functions, they and the public of a political subdivision will be immune for negligence. But when they cross the line and move into willful or wanton misconduct, then they lose the right to claim that immunity. And I think it serves an important governmental function, because having police, having fire, having EMS protection is important. We want to encourage swift response to emergency situations. And that's what Mr. Kennedy was doing in this situation. He was responding to a call for an emergency medical care. And absent a showing of willful or wanton misconduct, which is what the control standard has been in this state, there is no basis for imposing liability.
Do we treat the EMS driver with the less immunity than the police and fire?
No, I think they are essentially afforded the same quality of immunity, that is, when they are responding to an emergency call.
The police and fire have a greater ability to be immune than EMS drivers, and I just wanted to know if you knew what that distinction was.
I think I disagree in important ways with what Mr. Levy suggested, that somehow the functions that are served by EMS are less important, that there's less life-threatening situation, or less likely that EMS. I don't think there's any basis on that kind of distinction.
Well, we have a different statute.
We treat them any differently. He seems to suggest that we should treat EMS drivers different than police and fire because the function they're performing is less emergency.
No, I would disagree with you on that distinction. In a functional analysis, they're performing the same essential government function that nobody else can do.
Except the difference is, counsel, isn't it, that EMS drivers at stop signs and intersections are held to essentially a negligent standard, whereas police and fire are not, by the nature of the difference in the two sections of the statute. It just sets out at intersections and stop signs, we're going to require you to act with due regard and proper speed, but we didn't set that statutorily as a limit. So there is a negligent standard at stop signs and intersections for EMS.
I think I have at least two comments to make in regards to that. when we're talking about 4511.03, which is the statute that regulates going through an intersection, I think what we need to keep in mind is that the overriding purpose of that statute is one authorizing safety vehicles to proceed through the intersection. It is not so much a prohibitory statute, but it is one authorizing safety vehicles to proceed lawfully through an intersection, even though it is a red light or a stop sign. And I think that the history for that statute was, in fact, an earlier decision from this court in the 1920s that held that a safety vehicle could not proceed through such a safety control device. And subsequently, the General Assembly enacted that statute to authorize safety vehicles to go through. So I think the important thing...
Can fire trucks and police cruisers go through?
Yes, they can.
But they're not... Yeah, the statute says they all can.
I'm sorry, what?
Okay, but the immunity statute doesn't reference that ability for those two.
Right? True. And I think what we need to keep in mind in regards to that is that, as I've indicated, that statute is one authorizing a safety vehicle to go through, but it is not one that creates civil liability. And I think that is an important distinction, and indeed it is one that the General Assembly recognized under 2744.02b5, which is the fifth exception, where a statute creates liability, then the political subdivision can be immune. This statute does not create such a liability. It is, as I've indicated, really one authorizing a vehicle to go through. But the second, I think, concern that we should have about using this statute here is, as Justice Cook indicated, basically it is one that speaks to negligence. And the overriding purpose of the immunity statute in responding to the calls is whether or not the conduct is willful or wanton conduct. I think what's being urged here on the court is the court is being asked in an effort to impliedly import negligence principles into the application of this statute. And I think that is contrary to the legislative intent, because clearly under 2744.02b1c, the only language relating to the standard of conduct at issue is whether or not the conduct is willful or wanton. I think it's an unreasonable implication to suggest now that we revert back to the standard of negligence in order to determine whether or not we need to support it.
Counsel, help us understand it better. Where this fellow was headed when he got to this intersection, the ambulance driver.
Well, Director Miles, he was driving southbound.
Right.
E-87.
But he wasn't going to keep on going south, was he?
No. He
or he was going to crash into a parked car or the curb or something.
Correct.
And how wide is Superior?
Superior is a four-lane street.
With room for parking cars in addition to that?
I'm not sure about that.
So
I would only be comfortable in saying it's four lanes, possibly including parking.
So it might be six if you cut the parking.
I don't know that I've shown by the record.
And he went clear across Superior, apparently not able to turn in either direction. Maybe went. If this plaintiff hadn't been there, I guess we could presume he would have crashed into something else on the other side.
Well, no, I don't think that's a fair assumption at all. His intent was to make a right turn onto Superior. When he saw Mr. Harris's vehicle proceeding eastbound on Superior and realized that he was on ice.
Make a right turn.
Correct.
So he went... So he was going to make a right turn and go headlong into oncoming traffic?
No.
He's headed southbound.
He's headed southbound and then...
He's going to make a right turn on Superior.
Correct.
That would have him in the westbound lanes. This is a fellow in the far eastbound lane.
Correct.
So his driving... Any way you have it, if this person hadn't been there, the next car coming down the street would have found this ambulance clear over in the far eastbound lane, coming at him head on.
in the long lanes of traffic.
No, I think there may be some confusion as to how it occurred. His intent was to make a right turn. When he saw the Harris vehicle proceeding eastbound and realized he was on ice, Mr. Kennedy turned to the left in order to attempt to avoid striking that car, and it did proceed across the lanes.
Now, if checking it from wrong, if he's got any kind of control of this vehicle, he's never going to get over in the eastbound lanes when he comes to this intersection. It was not his intent to ever be over there. So Kennedy, so the plaintiff is no problem for him, right? I mean, if he's able to carry out what he intended to do when he got to this intersection, a right turn into the westbound lanes, seeing a car in the far eastbound lane, really shouldn't represent a problem of any kind to him.
But once again, assuming
he's under reasonable control.
And assuming Mr. Harris pulled over and stopped the traffic so there's not
no
way of an oncoming emergency.
Wait a minute. If he's going to turn right into westbound lanes, Harris doesn't matter whether he's pulled over or not, because he's never going to be over in eastbound lanes. Right. So he's just flat out of control when he gets at this intersection.
When he gets the ice, he's unable to stop the vehicle. That's undisputed. And at the very least, or at the best, that would show that there was negligence in the operation of the vehicle. But the standard under the Ohio statutes is whether or not the employee engaged in willful formally want.
Well, at the best, mightn't it show, and the plaintiff is entitled to the best, right? That's the standard.
That's right.
On summary judgment. At the best, wouldn't it show that he's going way too fast for the conditions?
No. The statute, as I say, is one authorizing one to proceed from an intersection, but even taking the other line to slow down as necessary. The testimony was that Mr. Kennedy slowed the vehicle between 5 to 7 miles per hour. There was no evidence offered to controvert that. And the plaintiffs would want to draw a lot of inferences and assume that, well, it could have been so, and we should almost assume against the credibility of Mr. Kennedy. There's no basis for that. There's no substantive evidence to dispute that he was going
Wouldn't the basis be, and I grant you, Justice Sweeney has pointed out, the plaintiff maybe should have had an accident reconstruction expert here, but wouldn't common knowledge almost indicate that if you're only going 5 to 10 mile an hour, even if it's ice, that you're not going to slide through three lanes of traffic, possibly four, if there's a parking lane, that's one, two westbound lanes, that's two, three, one eastbound lane, four, now you're in the fifth lane before you have the
conclusion. No, here's why. This is not a mere passenger vehicle that you and I drive for every day. This is a large ambulance, it's a wagon, and it's larger than a station wagon, it's a big truck. So the fact that it slid across lanes of traffic should not be any great surprise, because given the size of this vehicle, it's not like a passenger vehicle where you might want to draw that inference that they had to be going more than 5 to 10 miles per hour. There's no reason to draw that inference in this case.
Mr. Pan, I'm interested in the statute, just one more thing, because the idea of importing negligence into this statute, you want to tell us that 45.1103 is really an authorizing statute, doesn't create civil liability, and it should be treated as that. But the language of says that this is a defense that we're counting on in C. So it says it's a complete defense, full defense to such liability. And it's, so in order to take advantage of that full defense, one has to meet the three criteria, which includes being a licensed driver, being not acting in a willful and wanton manner. And then when it speaks to 45.1103, it says it complies with the precautions. So it's a criteria, isn't it, for taking advantage of the full defense, is to comply with the precaution criteria of 45.1. So isn't it? I mean, do you think it's not requiring no negligence at stop signs and intersections, even when there are emergency calls.
You may answer the question.
First of all, I think the controlling standard is still willful and wanton misconduct, because that's what 2744.02b1c says. With regard, though, to the 4511.03 provision, it states that shall slow down as necessary. It doesn't say what it takes to comply, what it means to comply with 4511.03, but I think when you look at the evidence of this case, it shows that Mr. Kennedy did comply with that statute.
Yeah, I know, we're not talking about the facts of this case, but just the statutory scheme should be what this court is considering. Does that, in order to get the defendant doesn't form, you have to drive at intersections and the lights with due regard for safety?
At all times, the statute still speaks in terms of willful and wanton misconduct. This statute does not say that for negligence you will be liable. It does not make carve out an exception for this kind of negligence. You are not entitled to it. It clearly speaks in terms of willful and wanton misconduct, and that we would suggest is
and the precautions of 4511.03.
Correct.
Speaks to both, doesn't it, Captain?
Yes, it does.
One could read the statute as requiring conduct which is not willful or wanton in all matters of driving other than when approaching a stop sign or an intersection, couldn't it? That seems to me to be what the General Assembly is saying, because it seems to have two tests in the same statute. 4511.03, as Justice Cook says, is written in negligence language. Due care is due regard is that's pretty good negligence language, isn't it?
It's great negligence language, but I think the reason why I disagree with your suggestion is if the General Assembly had intended to carve out this kind of negligence apart from immunity provisions, then the statute would have read, except for negligence and failing to comply with 4511.03, a political subdivision to be a PIP 1, 2, 3. But because it's all lumped together, the intent of the General Assembly appears to be that we will evaluate this on the standard of willful and wanton misconduct, not on a negligence standard.
Thank you, Mr. Hannon. Mr. Levy, you use your time, which may take 30 seconds, if you'd like.
Your Honor, very quickly, one, I think there is a negligence standard cut out for a very narrow segment of ambulance driving that when it reaches the dangerous intersection that tends to go through a stop sign or red light. Two, I think, yes, that the burden of the EMS unit to sound the siren is very minimal compared to the rest of the people using the highway. There should be an obligation that is mandatory, interpreted and reading 4511.03. Finally, Kennedy as an individual is personally liable under the express mandate of 4511.202, which exempts an EMS driver from liability of blizzard control if he complies with 4511.043 to sound the siren. There would be no purpose to exempt them in 4511.043 unless 4511.202 imposes that express liability. Otherwise, both staff, 4511.041 is fully available.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.
All right.